Okay, it's August 22nd, 2006, and I'm David Brooks, the interviewer for the University of Montana's Oral History Project. Today I'm talking with now Commissioner of Higher Education, Sheila Stearns. And Ms. Stearns, I was hoping you could start by just talking a little bit about your personal and educational background, what brought you to Missoula and the University of Montana to begin with.
Sure. I am Sheila McDonald Stearns. I don't generally go by my middle name, but when I started here as a student, of course, and all the years I was an undergraduate, I was Sheila McDonald. And I was I grew up in Glendive, Montana, and father a dentist, mother a librarian, and big family. I kind of wanted to go to the University of Minnesota, but a lot of kids in school, we chose in-state schools. And actually, most of us chose the University of Montana. One brother chose MSU. So I came here and decided to major in English and history because I couldn't really choose between them, and knew that I would probably teach, which I ended up doing. So that's what brought me to the university, and I graduated. I came in 1964 and graduated in 1968. I went right on. I got married in 68 and went right on to get my master's degree under Ross Toole immediately. So I got that within about 18 months. So I got my master's in 1969.
And that was in history?
That was in history, mm-hmm. Correct.
And so you went on to teach after that?
I did. Mm-hmm. I hurried to finish my master's degree. It was, I'll stop there for a moment and we can come back to it. It was called a case study in academic freedom. And it was a subject suggested to me by Dr. Toole, because it ends up being footnoted in one of his books, one of his subsequent, 20th Century Montana, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But he was curious about Arthur Fisher. It's called the Arthur Fisher Affair, and I'd be glad to come back to that. So when I finished I hurried to finish it because that year I had persuaded my husband, who was already teaching, that we would probably live, I said, in Missoula, Montana most of our lives. We really liked it. So we should do something adventurous. So we applied to Department of Defense schools and said that we would only take Europe. We didn't want to live in Greenland for a year. And lo and behold, that summer, we got a very plum assignment because someone retired at surprising at the last minute. So someone who probably was waiting in Greenland or Okinawa to get Wiesbaden, Germany, didn't get it, and we did. And so we went. Hal was hired. Even though I already had my teaching degree, you had to have had 2 years' experience to be hired by Department of Defense, but I went over as a dependent. Hal had a job, and I had a job within a month because they had more students, and I taught in junior high, English and social studies, and we taught there for 3 years.
And then you returned to Missoula?
We did. Mm-hmm. When we went, Hal took a 1 year leave of absence from Sentinel High School, mm-hmm. and then we kept extending it because we were having so much fun. And we finally got to the point, I think Hal would have stayed, and I once again said, no, we probably ought to return or we'll never get back. And partly it was because by then I was expecting, and I thought it would be nicer to raise our children around family, extended mm-hmm. family. So we came back 3 years later, and Hal went back to work for Sentinel High School, and he put in a full career in the 3 years at Sentinel before we left, and the 25, I believe, after we got back. During that time, he earned his doctorate here in education. Both of us had masters in history and both wanted to get our doctorates in history, but by then, we probably should have gotten our doctorates while we were overseas in the University of Maryland or Ball State or something, mm-hmm. For a little variety, but we were too busy having fun and seeing the world. So all of our degrees are from both of us from the university. No, he's an undergrad at Notre Dame, but all mine are from Montana because I ended up place bound. And the history PhD was in moratorium at that time, so I couldn't, and nor could he, get our doctorates in history. But in both of our cases, especially mine, the education school worked with the history department so that my committee of five for my dissertation, three were from the School of Education, but two were from history. And particularly, the leader was Dr. Robert Lindsay, who died a few years ago, but was one of my very favorite historians. He wasn't a Western historian, but he was, in fact, he was a Europeanist, but he was wonderful, and he was the main guide on my committee. Maybe not so much history, but sort of, you know, style and approach to writing a biography. And so it was, to the extent that a person in those days could get a doctorate in history, I kind of did. And finished that after a few years of raising my children, going back to work for a couple years as a school librarian. That was another sort of arrow I had in my quiver, was my mother had been a librarian, and I love, you know, I'm a bibliophile. So I was also a school librarian for a couple years in there. And when I resigned from that to have our second child, because I liked and enjoyed having a few years at home with each of my two babes, I used that chance to start going back for my doctorate.
Mm-hmm.
So I defended that in 83, the year that my youngest started first grade. So I kind of mixed the flexibility of graduate school, not that it wasn't onerous, but I had time and I was supported and I had a teaching assistantship, so I brought in a little bit of income to the family, but basically I got to, I thought, have the best of all worlds. I got to be essentially a stay-at-home mom, flexible at least, very flexible, and earn my doctorate, if not in history, at least in a very, well, you know, it would have been in the history department had they had the PhD at the time. And at the same time, I was getting the credentials to be a principal or superintendent, which is what I thought I would be when I grew up. I'd been in public education and was interested in leadership and had been encouraged, especially the years that I was a school librarian. I had been encouraged by my boss as the principals to get the credentials to be in charge of a school or schools. And I thought that sounded interesting, so I combined those and finished my doctorate in 83, and then started looking around the job market, and in fact was surprised that it wasn't in any big hurry, but that summer there was an unexpected retirement in July or so of one of the principals of the 18 elementary schools in School District 1 here in Missoula. And at that time, all 18 of those principals were men.
Mm-hmm.
But they decided to do a quick search and have a person, at least for an interim year. And at the same time, I was encouraged by the dean of the School of Education to apply for the head of the alumni office, because there had been kind of a, you know, some sort of event, and the previous alumni director had been quite a senior officer at the university, someone I knew and respected, and she had resigned. So that position was open. And so I applied for both, thinking that one was more frivolous, probably a lark, but I would apply. And the other one was probably my career path.
Mm-hmm.
But without going into boring details, I was offered both jobs the same week, about the third week of August. And just kind of the way the president and vice president of the University of Montana pitched the alumni job to me was more intriguing and frankly more challenging. In other words, they said, well, you can see we just fired, in effect, the person who was here, and you it's a very important position to us, and we will be starting our first ever capital campaign, and we need good relationships with alumni, and we need an office that gets into the 20th century, or at least the 1980s, and we need a lot of change, and you'll sink or swim, you know, or not. And I thought that sounded, you know, nice, open-ended, give me a lot of responsibility, but let me try to build it up and make it work. And the other one, they had that, they weren't sure whether it would be an interim and do another search, and they kind of, how should I say it, conditioned it on all, well, we'll have a personnel officer to help you if you have to hire anyone, and we'll have a curriculum officer, at the central office, if you have to make any curriculum decisions and so on. We have a budget officer, and they, the administration of the school district was much more, frankly, condescending, patronizing.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though that was my career field, the other sounded more of a challenge. And I would never have thought it. I had no idea really what an alumni office did, but I knew it would be in higher ed and it would be interesting and fun, and I could do it for a couple years and get back into public education where I thought is where I belonged. But I ended up really liking the alumni position, and they did give me a lot of responsibility, and we did start the Capitol. The president, President Bucklew, and Vice President Easton, and the UM Foundation started the first Capitol campaign, which resulted in, it was a $6 million campaign, which sounds so small now. The university's just finishing a $100 million campaign, but seemed big to us then, especially since half of it, $3 million, was going to go to build a new stadium. And so we needed, of course, or the president believed, I think correctly, that they needed to balance that with endowed chairs, or not chairs, but he called them endowed stools, you know, academically, you know, related things for library and other
mm-hmm.
worthy goals, more academic and student oriented than a stadium. So I did that job for 4 years, and then my boss, the Vice President Easton, Mike Easton, took a position as they called it provost at that time in Dillon, when Dillon was administratively attached in 1987 to the University of Montana. So he went to Dillon as the provost. And then I served as an interim role in his job as vice president for a year, and they had a national search. And I competed for it and was selected to become the permanent vice president. So mm-hmm. there I ended up in higher education administration,
mm-hmm.
sort of by, I won't say by chance, but not something I ever thought I was going to be when I grew up, and certainly not something I thought that I would be heading toward when I was writing either my master's thesis or my doctoral dissertation or doing my graduate work. Although some of my graduate work, of course, was in general administration and educational administration, and that was, of course, helpful.
Mm-hmm. I want to return to something you mentioned, a few things you mentioned earlier. One is just Missoula in general. You started out by saying you figured you would live here. You and your husband both really liked it. You came from Glendive and had that evaluation of it, and still apparently thought that after being in Germany and having, as you said, a good time for 3 years.
Right.
What was Missoula like and the university that attracted you to come back here?
Even then, and maybe always, Missoula has been an interesting university town with a strong emphasis on the liberal arts, which now almost any college or university has, you know, a good comprehensive liberal arts core for its graduates. But just the excitement of various lectures, concerts, of it, the availability of the buzz, just the intellectual and buzz of the town, and it was pretty. It is pretty. It was still suffering then from a real haze, a real Horner Waldorf, they called it, the old pulp mill. They hadn't cleaned it up, and granted, it still suffers inversions, but that was the only downside.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my first visit to Missoula was in a summer with my family on an around Montana trip, and the trees, especially in the university area, that just wasn't, and that with a mountain right there, just we just liked it physically,
mm-hmm.
even though we both now are very, very attached and love going back to our home areas. I think the Eastern Yellowstone River Valley is much more gorgeous than I really appreciated growing up. I liked it growing up. I hiked in Mikoshika, but I like it even better now. And Hal is from the Harlaton area in central Montana, which is stunningly beautiful. So as we've grown, we've realized that we are from all over Montana, are just beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful land. So I'm not sure, but the presence of the university in a town that was just a little bigger and more exciting caused us to think, we want to live in Montana. If you want to live in Montana, where do you want to live? For us, it was just Missoula, mm-hmm. just no question.
So along with that, you know, you had the opportunity to study with K. Ross Toole, as mm-hmm. you mentioned, and he certainly is a standout figure in the history department here, if not the university. So I'd like you to reminisce a little about him, studying under him, and the department at the time, as well as you mentioned that the PhD was in moratorium mm-hmm. when you got finished with your MA degree.
Right.
So talk about that and that,
okay.
that happening.
I'm not sure when the history degree went into moratorium, the PhD, because I wasn't interested right away, but mm-hmm. at least it was by the time we returned from Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And I might have, and when Hal was getting interested first and I subsequently. Ross Toole was an icon, even on campus, even then, although, and the history department was large and robust. It had, you know, Jack Van de Wettering and, you know, a Russian scholar, Wren, I believe was his last name, and just all kinds of, I don't know, I think in the enrollment cutbacks of 1977, the history department lost a few lines, but in the 60s, late 60s and early 70s, it was just large and bustling and robust and just full of interesting faculty. And I'm sure it's always stayed that way, but it did have a drop off and has certainly built back up since then. But gosh, you know, Hal and I were, Hal especially, even more than I, was interested in Western history. And I was interested always a little bit more in the history of ideas than in kind of facts and places.
Mm-hmm.
So different sorts of Western history appeal to us. So I was not interested. His master's degree was on the place where he grew up, a history of the Musselshell Valley. And my master's degree was on an academic freedom case, you know, mm-hmm. here at the university. So Ross Toole, Hal became his graduate student, I believe, in 65, when Ross first came over from the Historical Society. And Hal says, I assume it's true, that he, my husband, was Ross Toole's first graduate student. He may not have been the first one to finish, although mm-hmm. that may have been the case as mm-hmm. well. So he got his master's degree. So we kind of knew, you know, got to know Ross Toole, especially through Hal a little bit. And then when I finished my English degree, English history, I took the GRE, knew I wanted to do history, and went, Hal said, go see Ross Toole, go see Ross. And so I did. And Ross was, said, boy, these are great GRE scores. You know, we want you to stay here. We want you to study history. And so that I was, of course, flattered and interested. And I said, well, nothing I love more than history, if I can find a master's degree topic that interests me. And so he was fun. You could drop into his office anytime. He was very witty. As you probably, everyone knows, he was handsome and, you know, confident and funny and easygoing. And so we you know, kind of, I started my courses and we kind of poked around, and he said, presented me several ideas that, and his seminar, his was famous, that Ross Toole's seminar for his graduate students. Again, we would write and he would critique our work, but basically he would let us critique each other. We were much harder on each other than he was often. He was a beautiful writer, as everyone knows, but not that harsh of a critic. You know, we really in some ways learned more from each other than, but it was a great experience. And I didn't spend much time with my fellow graduate students. I had the luxury, again, of being supported that year, knowing that I wanted to do something the next year. So I just took a full load. I wasn't teaching, you know, I wasn't a teaching assistant then. So I was just clicking right through and didn't get to know people like Brian Cockhill as well as I would have liked. They were graduate students at the same time I was. You know, in retrospect, I know you'll learn a lot. But Dr. Toole was, Even then, always an excellent speaker, lecturer, teacher. He was gentle. He was very bright, and just a great person to study with. It was a great 18 months. And then I needed to go up. He and his wife had a ranch in the Bitterroot Valley, and I needed to run because of the speeded up process so I could get to Europe. I drove to take, you know, a draft of my, what I hoped was the final draft of my master's thesis for him to look at and approve for a quick scheduling of a defense. And he loved it. He said, "This is terrific," and scheduled the defense, and we got it done. And I think I flew out the next day. But that's how he was to work mm-hmm. with. And the graduate school was very accommodating as well. He was excellent. And during that time, he said, "One of the people you should interview for this is a guy who lives up north of here, near Charlo, and his name is Ray Logan. And he is a brother-in-law of Arthur Fisher." Is that right? A brother-in-law? A relative. Maybe kind of a cousin-in-law. And he said he was in Chicago when Arthur Fisher, and they came from this distinguished Fisher family in Chicago. In fact, to this day, just the other day, I heard somebody mentioning the book Getting to Yes, which is written, one of the co-authors is Roger Fisher. And Roger Fisher is the son of one of those Fishers, you know, Arthur's mm-hmm. siblings. And Ray Logan, when he was in Chicago, married one of the Fisher, you know, a lady who'd been married to the Fishers. Anyway, long story. But at any rate, I said, that's a good idea. So I went up, and I spent a wonderful day working on my doctorate to visit Ray Logan about the whole Winnetka thing, it's actually more his years in Montana. And when I got back, one of my fellow graduate students said to me, "You interviewed Ray Logan?" And I said, "Yeah, Ross tipped me off to go see him." And he said, "Well, did you ask him all about the Winnetka plan?" And I said, you know, at that time I was getting my master's in history, not education. I hadn't learned much about that. And I said, peripherally, sheepishly I said this. And he said, "Well, you ought to go back, because that's where he's famous in his own right, not just what he knew about his brother-in-law, Arthur Fisher." And I said, "Oh." So I'll come back to Ross in a moment, but a few years later, gosh, mid-70s, late-70s, when I went to see Ross Toole and I decided I was ready to work on a doctorate, and the School of Education was willing for me to have a historical mm-hmm. Dissertation. I went, Ross, it was in his last year or two teaching. I went up to his office and I said, "Ross, is it true? I think I heard recently that no one has even yet written the," this is almost 8-9 years later, maybe 10, "no one's written the story of Ray Logan and the Winnetka plan and his work in Montana before he went there." And Ross said, "No." And I said, "You know, that's what if I go for my doctorate, that's what I'd love to do for a dissertation." And he said, "That is a terrific idea." But he didn't say, he was retiring and, you know, frankly, getting sick. So he didn't stay to be on my committee for my doctorate, but he passed it off to a couple mm-hmm. of other guys in the department. So he was wonderful to work with, and he got me started on both of the topics for my master's and my doctorate, my dissertation. Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking of the years that you were in school here, and mentioning that your undergraduate was partially in the English department as mm-hmm. well, and those mm-hmm. are years that there were some fairly well-known folks in mm-hmm. the English department.
Yes. Interestingly, the best known, Leslie Fiedler, left his last year was 63-64, and I started in the fall of 64. Mm-hmm. So I never got to take a class from Leslie Fiedler. Mm-hmm. I would have loved to. My older sister got to. And I'm going to not think of their names right offhand, you know, some other luminaries in that English department. several of whom, Jesse Beer, you know, several of whom I did get to take classes from, and they were, it was like the history department. And that was, gosh, I just thought those mid-60s, when they were ramping up to teach all of us baby boomers, that those departments were full of interesting mm-hmm. people. So the English department as well, Walter King was my advisor, and he became an icon. Particularly, he was a British literature expert, and I took every Walter King course I could and loved it, loved him. So yeah, that was a robust, exciting department as well. So I thought that, you know, what how could you have more fun in those years, at least, than to major in English and history?
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in your ability to have the School of Education and the History Department cooperate on a PhD. Mm-hmm. And I've heard from many people I've interviewed doing oral histories that, you know, there was a certain time at the university, and in places it still exists, that there was just maybe a greater sense of fraternity or fellowship between departments within the faculty. Perhaps it was school size. Was that your ability to do that coincide with that? Does that even make sense to talk about?
No, I understand what you're saying, and I, as a student, would not really have been attuned enough to say how mm-hmm. the faculty relationships were, mm-hmm. and probably would have been too naive to think that if I thought something might work, at least not to ask. Mm-hmm. I do have to point out, of course, that what I earned was an EDD, because mm-hmm. there was not a PhD. Mm-hmm. And over the years, it sort of amuses me, because in many venues, not all, you know, an EDD, you do not have to do a serious, difficult, challenging dissertation. I did, and mm-hmm. I think many did in those years. So to me, I felt very fortunate. But at any rate, in terms of them working together, my advisor thought it was a great idea. Bill Fisher, wonderful fellow, just died a couple years ago, and he taught some of the foundation courses. And he was a genuine intellectual. He taught the history of education and the philosophy of education, sociology of education, and he had studied at Columbia. So he certainly, I don't think he was a best friend of the historians, but he knew them, and I don't think Bill published. He was not of the stature maybe that they were, but he certainly knew his field and was respected, and he became my mentor in the School of Education, and said, when I said, actually he was the one who told me that, I said, I'd rather do something historical. I think he was the one that tipped me off that the Ray Logan story had not been written. And I said, and he knew about that from the foundations of education. Mm-hmm. So I just think that at least among a few faculty, there were enough connections in the field they were all in the LA building. Maybe they all still are. No, School of Education, of course, is in a different building now, but I just ran from one floor to the next and caught Ross in his office. That was so exciting to me. I said, Bill, you know, Dr. Fisher just told me that, you know, this is, and Ross said, yeah, what a great idea. And yeah, you know, they just, I don't think it was any problem mm-hmm. at all. And probably unusual, but it just, I was too young or too detached from academic politics to know if it was unusual.
Right. I mean, it seems common now that people have one outside reader from a different department. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, there is a PhD, I believe, in interdisciplinary studies now on campus. Mm-hmm. But that seems sort of like a middle ground between those two.
Mm-hmm.
So exactly. Perhaps it was unique.
And I don't know if Dr. Toole knew this or not. I think he did. When I graduated, I really wanted to go to the University of Minnesota. Remember, I told you I wanted to go as an undergrad. I wanted to go again. And they had a well-respected American studies, because I was more of an interdisciplinaryist, to mm-hmm. make up a word. I hope no one ever quotes it. And Hal wanted to get his doctorate, and I wanted to work on my master's toward a doctorate. I really was interested in becoming a faculty member at a college or university. And it was just some, you know, kind of a glitch that I got accepted to the University of Minnesota right away, and Hal's didn't come, and it got close to our wedding, and he needed to sign a contract, or we wouldn't have a job the next year. And we decided, well, we could stay in Montana one more year and go to Minnesota the year after and to be on the safe side and sign that contract with Missoula County High School. Well, by then, you know, I was working on a master's degree here that I enjoyed, and then got that Europe idea. So, you know, at one point I had considered a PhD and had been accepted in a master's PhD program in American Interdisciplinary Studies, but, you know, the road not taken. Mm-hmm. But I ended up, I think, crafting here in Montana a wonderful academic experience with two mm-hmm. degrees. You know, they were parochial, provincial, in the sense that they're all from the same university. But I would argue that the quality of the professors that I had, in, especially in English and history, and some of the education professors, in fact, most, was outstanding. And mm-hmm. so I don't regret my degrees at all. I think they well prepared me for this huge variety of careers I've had since.
Well, speaking of your variety of careers, let's fast forward to you no longer being a student and your first job with the university, which was the Alumni Association. And
yes.
I want you to talk a little bit about the importance of that capital campaign. And was that, you know, now a lot of the university is really privately funded. There are more and more private grants on campus all the time in different departments, as well as something like the Coca-Cola contract mm-hmm. that has recently happened on campus. Was that really that pivotal of a time, that first capital campaign? Did it fit into a shift in funding on campus at all?
Oh, it definitely was the harbinger of a shift. Not quite so much in the research area. That really bloomed and took off later in the late 80s, early 90s. And I would say that President George Denison in particular, you know, put a lot of weight, if you will, kind of support behind the growth of that area. But and private fundraising as well. But every college or university, depending kind of on its maturation and its dependence on state support, begins to realize, especially if it has a huge or large group of alumni who love it and remember it fondly, you know, every university begins to learn you are not taking advantage of the support and the scholarships at the very least that you could get for your students, not mm-hmm. to mention grants. Mm-hmm. If you don't take advantage of that. So that was very pivotal. You know, bigger colleges and universities reached that stage two or three decades earlier. Mm-hmm. And University of Montana's foundation was founded in the late, early 50s maybe. But it didn't, you know, it wasn't beginning to really mature enough to undertake a major capital campaign. So I would say it was very pivotal, but nothing happens overnight. That capital campaign ended up raising, I don't know, I think 7 or 8 million, and we all felt very proud of that. And I remember a lot of details about it. Someone, if you ever, you know, to interview Monica Paoli, who lives in town, she was Monica Conrad at that time, and, you know, do you hire an outside counsel or do you get inside people like Monica, who had worked for Governor Schwinden, who kind of know the lay of the land and have a good way with people. So at any rate, you know, President Bucklew knew, coming from Ohio University, and prior to that, he'd been provost at Ohio University. He knew that no university that really wants to grow up can do so without private funds to supplement mm-hmm. the state base. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was pivotal. It became very clear to the administration and to the I think the faculty, and certainly to the foundation members, that was key. You needed to have private support. And then gradually the private support kind of branched into two areas. The private support for scholarships, for endowed chairs, you know, for buildings, projects, and then the grants and research, you know, took off. You know, they had to bifurcate at mm-hmm. some point. They used to have for a while, a combined office in the 70s, maybe up through even the 70s before they split offices. And both of them have matured magnificently, I think, and really enriched the university and, pun intended, enriched it in all kinds of ways.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, I know you've got to end here, and we'll continue the interview later. Thank you.
Okay.